Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Intercepted. Welcome to Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill. The U.S.-backed Israeli war against Gaza is now entering its fifth month. It would be impossible to overstate the horrifying destruction that has been unleashed on the people of Gaza. More than 27,000 have been killed. The vast majority, 70% of them, are women and children. More than 66,000 others are injured. And these statistics are likely a dramatic undercount. Thousands of people remain missing. Many of them are lying dead under the rubble of what was once their homes. More than 80% of Gaza's Palestinians are now internally displaced and are being corralled under threat of bombing into an ever-shrinking killing cage as the Israelis begin to lay siege to Rafah along the Egyptian border.
Yes, well, in, overnight, and in fact, it started at early hours of last night in the evening hours with the heavy artillery shelling of the eastern part of Rafah City and finishing at about midnight with massive airstrikes on both different locations in eastern Rafah and in the central part of Rafah City, very crowded and densely populated two areas. The one in eastern Rafah, a residential home full of displaced Palestinians, including the owner.
Two-thirds of Gaza's hospitals have now been rendered entirely inoperable. Famine is spreading. Clean water is scarce. Doctors are performing limb amputations on children with no anesthesia. Some patients are dying from the shock of the excruciating pain. Women are having C-sections with no anesthetics. Israel has enforced a wartime blockade on the entry of aid. That's resulted in only a tiny fraction of what the UN and other organizations say would be necessary to even begin to address the horrifying reality.
First to Gaza, where WHO continues to face extreme challenges in supporting the health system and health workers. As of today, over 100,000 Gazans are either dead, injured, or missing and presumed dead. WHO has faced great difficulty even to reach hospitals in southern Gaza. Heavy fighting has been reported near hospitals in Khan Yunis, severely impeding access to health facilities for patients, health workers, and supplies.
The World Food Program has for weeks been warning that Gaza is facing catastrophic hunger and starvation. People in Gaza have an average of just 1.5 liters of water per day. That's to drink, to wash with, to cook with. Chronic diarrhea is rampant among children. There's been a 2,000% increase since Israel launched its invasion and bombing in October. Milk and formula are now scarce. Newborns are having to eat solid foods long before their bodies are ready for it, causing other health issues. There's an average of one toilet per 480 people in shelters in Gaza.
As they respond to the October 7th attack by Hamas, Israeli forces have destroyed many Palestinian schools and universities. The places flattened include Isra University in Gaza City.
With no shelter and limited supplies, these displaced Gazans have been living on the streets of Khan Yunis. Some have seen their homes demolished by Israeli airstrikes, and fear that nowhere in the enclave is safe.
We begin in Gaza, where Israeli forces are showing no signs of slowing their attacks. The main building of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis is amongst the latest targets. Troops are surrounding the facility, and intense bombing has been taking place around it overnight. Gaza's health ministry says no one has been able to enter or exit the hospital, which was already struggling to treat the wounded.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's universities and schools, its healthcare centers, its archives, its libraries. It's engaging in controlled demolitions of entire neighborhoods, blowing up apartment complexes, destroying farms and other agricultural areas. More than 60% of Gaza's homes have been destroyed or significantly damaged. There are reports of mass executions of prisoners and widespread torture of other Palestinians. And at every turn, Netanyahu and his henchmen have made clear that they intend to continue their campaign indefinitely, even as their military forces face a quagmire in their military battle against the Qassam brigades and other Palestinian fighters. And Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, he's back in the Middle East and continues to reiterate that the U.S. opposes a permanent ceasefire.
On this vote, the yeas are 226, the nays are 196. The bill is passed.
The U.S. House passed a bill to provide almost $15 billion in aid to Israel on Thursday.
The U.S. continues to rush weapons and ammunition to Israel to continue this slaughter. And at the same time, the Biden administration has led the charge to cut funding to UNRWA, perhaps the most important international organization operating on the ground in Gaza. The U.S. and other nations have accepted, without any actual concrete evidence, Israel's accusation that a tiny number of UNRWA staff participated in the October 7th attacks. This is an organization with 30,000 employees, more than 12,000 of them inside Gaza itself, and the U.S. has admitted that it didn't even bother to check the facts on its own, and yet has now allowed the Israeli government's propaganda to replace any sort of independent U.S. policy. The U.S. is outsourcing even the minimal semblance of independence to an extreme Israeli agenda against the most important aid organization in Gaza. That's the fact.
The UN's humanitarian coordinator for Gaza said it was vital for UNRWA to be able to continue with its work.
There's no substitution for the humanitarian role that is played in Gaza. We need to all ramp up, given the totality of needs and the scale and the complexity of the crisis, but there's no substitution.
And all of this comes as Biden is pushing for an additional $14 billion of new cash to Tel Aviv for Israel's war against the people of Gaza. This is all happening as the International Court of Justice ruled that South Africa's genocide case against Israel can proceed. The court explicitly ordered Israel to allow with immediate effect the delivery of humanitarian aid. The main UN humanitarian organization, OCHA, says that in January, Israel blocked 66% of its planned missions to deliver aid to Gaza. Israel has intensified its attacks against UNRWA and the UN in a clear attempt to distract from the ICJ ruling. It also happens at a time when a federal judge in California has ruled that the Biden administration is plausibly supporting genocidal actions by continuing to arm and back Israel. The U.S. is not some outside observer. It is complicit in all of this. It's an active partner in the carnage, the bombings, the attacks against defenseless civilians. And it's leading the international charge to defund the most important aid organization operating in Gaza. And yet we're told that Biden, who apparently spends his mornings watching Morning Joe on MSNBC, is losing patience with Netanyahu. This apparently is the Democrats' emerging strategy for 2024. Blame the war all on Bibi's extremism and gaslight everyone by claiming that Joe Biden was somehow a voice of moderation. Well, in the real world, Biden almost can't give a speech anywhere now without it being disrupted by protesters confronting him for his support of this scorched earth war. And the White House says it doesn't want a wider war in the Middle East, and yet it's expanding its bombing campaigns in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, and says it's going to continue indefinitely.
The bodies of Iraqis killed in this weekend's airstrikes were buried today. With speeches from pro-Iranian leaders calling for America to be cleaned from the country. Iraq's prime minister visited the wounded in the hospital, the strikes aiming to punish Iran and Iranian-backed groups for the attack that killed three U.S. soldiers. But the Pentagon admitting today there are no reports of Iranians killed or injured.
None of this is going to be neatly wrapped up in time for the 2024 election, and the White House knows it because they're fueling it. They're hoping that Trump's insanity is going to somehow save Biden, that people will let Biden off the hook for supporting and facilitating this genocidal war because they're terrified of Trump. But the indications, at least right now, is that this is far from a guarantee. Biden's ratings are in the toilet. And he's made clear he doesn't care about the concerns of so many voters in the U.S. who are appalled at what he's doing right now to the people of Gaza. This isn't just Israel's war. It's a joint U.S.-Israeli war. And no amount of spin is going to wipe the blood off the hands of the U.S. officials who waged it. But it's not just the U.S. that has steadfastly backed this scorched earth war. It's virtually the entire Western establishment, with a few notable exceptions. Canada, they're all in. Britain, all in. France, all in. Germany, enthusiastically all in. It's this coalition of the killing and what motivates these nations to support Israel's war of annihilation that we're going to focus on today's program. Our guest is Mohammed El Naim, a political educator and director of the Decolonial Center in London. He's an advocate of anti-colonial politics and works with his colleagues to amplify anti-colonial work and activism. Mohammed, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to Intercepted.
Thank you.
Mohammed, I want to begin with narrative. The narrative that has been deployed by, not just by Israel, but by the United States and the European countries that are supporting Israel's war against Gaza. First of all, just start off by giving your broad reflections on how the story of this war, how it began, how it's been waged, what that has looked like from the United States and European capitals.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, first of all. One of the things that has been kind of horrific for a lot of us to see is the ways in which a certain kind of narrative, a European exceptionalist narrative, and I say Europe and its offshoots in the sense that the United States is an offshoot of it, it's part of the same global political culture, of almost needing to be entirely uncritical of Israel and the way in which Israel is waging what's effectively, and even by the ICJ, potentially a genocidal war against the people of Gaza. For the longest time, when you're looking at the media in general and other topics, the idea of like Noam Chomsky's idea that the role of the media is just to manufacture consent for everybody to fall in line with the foreign policy of the United States and Europe seems to be a bit oversimplistic. But then all of a sudden you're watching the media and, you know, this is a live stream genocide. The evidence is irrefutable. It's publicly available. And the way in which the media kind of tiptoes around it, both sides, it makes it seem as if it's not important that a genocide is taking place, or sometimes just by omission, just pretends that this isn't happening. I mean, you start to really buy into the idea that Chomsky had, which is that the role of the media is to manufacture consent. And I think one of the things is that this is a ripe moment for the far right to recruit, because this is also a moment where it becomes very easy to buy into conspiracy theories which are anti-Semitic, that the reason why we're seeing this is because there must be a conspiracy, you know, control, you know, Israel's controlling the media, etc. And so for me, it's like, I'm obviously someone of colonized descent. My dad was born during the time when Britain had still colonized Sudan. And I'm watching the media, and I'm watching, for example, the right-wing media, and there's just sitting down there discussing. Julia Hartley Brewer had a guest on, just casually discussing if ethnic cleansing is a potential solution, you know, to the Gaza question. Or when you watch a person who maybe has had tens of their family members killed in Israeli airstrikes, and they're asked to condemn Hamas, the lack of shame, the lack of empathy, you have to try to understand where is this coming from. And if you reject a kind of conspiratorial anti-Semitic account, then you're probably going to come to the conclusion that there's something culturally. What's the cultural reason for how, in the name of anti-Semitism, which generally means in the name of being against genocide, people are being actively complicit in genocide? And so for me, a part of the way in which I'm seeing the narrative is where is that coming from? And I think for me, the diagnosis to that problem is quite simply that all of these people in the cultural industry, the curators, the journalists, there's no malign intent. There's no need to engage in some kind of like double standard. There's a cultural problem here, which is making them complicit in genocide. And that's kind of what I've been interested in when it comes to the narratives.
You know, a lot of times people focus on the fact that the United States, because it's the greatest bankroller of Israel in general and the biggest sponsor of Israel specifically in this war of annihilation in Gaza, and to a lesser extent, of course, the British government, which also is a very steadfast supporter of Israel, including when it's at its most violent. But what we're seeing is other European nations becoming very, very outspoken, not just in their defense of Israel, but their specific defense of Israel's tactics in Gaza. And I'm speaking specifically of the German government, which has certainly increased its spending on weapons. We've seen that on full display in the NATO-Ukraine-Russia conflict, but also now Germany talking about actually exporting offensive weaponry to Israel. And in fact, you received, Mohammed, a lot of attention for a series of posts that you made on social media when the German government chose to announce its support for Israel as it faced its genocide allegations at the International Court of Justice brought by South Africa. Germany announced that it was supporting Israel in its case at the ICJ on the very day that in Namibia, people were marking the 100th anniversary of the German genocide in Namibia. And I'd like for you to tell that story and offer your reflections on it, but also to speak specifically to how you see Germany, which, of course, murdered 6 million Jews in World War II, and not just Jews, also communists, Roma people, Slavic people, gay people, etc. But the country that waged this genocidal war in World War II is now taking the side of the Israeli state, which was created in the aftermath of that genocide in Europe at the expense of the forced expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, now forcefully defending what many in the world believe is an ongoing genocide against the Palestinians of Gaza.
The honest truth is that when we're hearing what's happening to Palestinian and a lot of, you know, brown activists of diaspora descent who are fighting for Palestine in Germany, let's just talk about that and more broadly the decisions that Germany's made on the international stage. And you're hearing stories of police officers coming in and destroying candlelight vigils for Shireen Abu Akleh, or police officers engaging in coordinated campaigns in across 7 different states, going into offices and making sure people don't have the wrong literature and they're not Hamas supporters. When you're seeing these stories of peaceful protests happening in the area of Neukölln in Berlin, and then the police just coming in and rampaging, I mean, these are moments and these are kinds of images which should make Germany ashamed, but also should give them pause as to not reenact the historic crime which they committed upon the Jewish people and many others, which was the Holocaust. And then on the international stage, to see Germany supporting Israel unconditionally, even as Israel is potentially waging a genocide. And on the day of the anniversary of the Naaman Herero genocide, I mean, these are all moments where you think, this is, again, it's one of those moments where don't they get it? And for me, the question is, why don't they get it? And so the series of tweets that I wrote was an attempt to try to understand that question. And my conclusion is that a lot of people will claim that drawing any comparisons of the Holocaust with another event is a form of relativizing the Holocaust. Whereas for me, I think that one of the biggest problems for Europe, actually, and it's part of the why they don't get it, and Europe and its offshoots, is actually exceptionalizing the Holocaust in the sense that, of course, in many ways, the Holocaust was exceptionally brutal, a unique event, and one of the most horrific events to have ever happened. It's a stain on the history of humanity. But at the same time, the logic which went into the Holocaust preceded the Holocaust, and it succeeded the Holocaust. What I mean by this is, you know, in the 1940s, Aimé Césaire, who was from Martinique, wrote this book called Discourse on Colonialism. And he made the claim that actually the thing that upset Europe the most about the Holocaust wasn't the techniques. He said it was the fact that those techniques were reserved solely for the people in the colonies, for African slaves, for what he called the Indian coolies, and that they were now coming to the soil of Europe. And he called it a boomerang effect. And a century prior to that, Amy Ashwood Garvey, who was the, you know, an incredible thinker and an anti-colonialist who was a mentor to some of the first leaders of African independent countries, when Italy, fascist Italy, had invaded Ethiopia, went to Trafalgar Square and stood on the stage and said, the only thing in between you and fascism is us, the anti-colonialists. And the reason was quite simple, that, for example, just to take the case of the Holocaust and how it connects directly to the Nama and Herero genocide, a lot of the key ideas of Nazi ideology were formulated in response to the conquest of what's present-day Namibia. And even the concept of a Lebensraum, and I may be pronouncing that wrong, and I'm sorry if I am, but the idea that there needs to be fertile land for, you know, the ills of industrialization, for German, the Volk, to be revitalized, which was an idea that made its way into Mein Kampf, was an idea that was developed by Ratzel in response to the Nama and Herero genocide and in encouragement of it. But more importantly than that, the Nama and Herero genocide was the first genocide that Germany committed in the 20th century. And it committed that genocide. Obviously, it developed a whole repertoire of ideas and techniques and ways of corralling people, concentrating them in certain places, killing them, you know, depriving them of their rights, and then eventually exterminating them. And obviously, that went into German statecraft and informed the Holocaust. But it's much deeper than that, because we're not just talking about the Nama and Herero genocide. We're talking about the techniques that the British used in Kenya, in the Mau Mau emergency, and also in the Boer War. We're talking about what the Italians did in Libya. We're talking about what the Italians did in Ethiopia. And just to kind of show you the difference between the case of the Nama and Herero genocide, I mean, Germany only recognized and apologized for it a few years ago. And the amount of money that they sent as reparations, or so-called reparations, was a pittance compared to the amount of money that the German state gave on the founding of Israel in the Claims Conference. And we're talking about something like, what, $3 billion? Most German kids don't know about the Nama and Herero genocide. But so then why then is there this exceptionalizing narrative? Well, there have been scholars have described many reasons for why. But I think one of the most important things is a form of self-identity, right? That to be a person of a civilized country in Europe and Europe's offshoots, whether we're talking about the United States, et cetera, is to understand that post-1945, this was an era where we, you know, fascism was an aberration. It had nothing to do with, you know, we are actually heirs of the Enlightenment, and we promised to say never again. And part of saying never again means unconditionally supporting Israel, because Israel is the incarnation of Jewish self-determination. I mean, this is the rationale, right? But for me, it's the main problem, and the reason why maybe Europe and its offshoots are doomed to constantly be complicit in genocide, and here we're talking about a difference of magnitude only, is because of the exceptionalizing narrative, which has nothing to do with, it claims to seek penance for Jewish people, but it's actually about trying to absolve oneself in order to continue a system which claims to be predicated on ideals of the Enlightenment, like humanism and freedom and liberty, but which actually, by necessity, has to desecrate all of those values. And the only way in which you can continue with a system like that is to tell yourself a nice, soothing story that you are post-Holocaust, that you've learned from that, and that proof of that is unconditional support for Israel. And I think this is damaging, because what it means is that we're going to have to continue to see genocide as a permanent fixture of society, and we've got to push back against that. And so that, for me, is one of the most horrifying aspects of the narrative which Europe tries to tell itself and so-called global North countries.
I want to just read from the post from the Namibian president, who, by the way, just passed away this past weekend. But on the day that the German government announced on 13th of January, 2024, that it was going to be supporting Israel at the International Court of Justice, the president of Namibia posted on social media, "Germany cannot morally express commitment to the United Nations Convention Against Genocide, including atonement for the genocide in Namibia, whilst supporting the equivalent of a Holocaust and genocide in Gaza. Various international organizations, such as Human Rights Watch, have chillingly concluded that Israel is committing war crimes in Gaza. And the president of Namibia said that he was appealing to the German government to reconsider its untimely decision to intervene as a third party in defense and support of the genocidal acts of Israel before the International Court of Justice. Now, that's the Namibian president, but the overarching narrative that Israel promoted about South Africa taking it to the International Court of Justice on charges that it was violating the Genocide Convention was that South Africa itself is the problem, that South Africa is a corrupt government, that South Africa has no moral standing to bring such charges against Israel, and that in fact it's a complete atrocity that South Africa would dare to use the term genocide against the Israeli state, which was established in the aftermath of the genocide of World War II. And, you know, a lot of what happened was this attempt to say, don't look at the 84-page filing, 9 pages of which consisted of statements from Israeli officials, clearly making statements that could be interpreted as genocidal intent. Instead, look at South Africa's problem. What the Israelis also rejected was a notion that there was any historical significance to South Africa, a nation that suffered under an apartheid system that was backed by Western countries led by the United States for decades, that had no relevance whatsoever to the proceedings in court.
That's exactly, you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, one of the things about the narrative, which I'm talking about right now, is the fact that Netanyahu himself has said that this is a struggle between light and darkness, right? This is a struggle between civilization and animals. At the Decolonial Center, we hold that actually the main ideas which make colonialism possible and justified continued until the present. And I think that this is a perfect example of that. First of all, I am extremely critical of the current government of South Africa, right? The current government of South Africa has a lot to answer for to its people. But the way to delegitimize that is actually kind of also tapping into a part of the psyche, which sees these countries as, you know, as whole countries, like what Trump said, that these are corrupt backwater countries that you can't trust them. And what do they know about genocide? So that's one where it's basically a reiteration of, okay, if they're so uncivilized, how can you expect them to say anything? And if you look on social media, and sort of, especially like Israeli social media and far right Israeli social media, you'll see a lot more overt expressions of what I'm trying to explain. But it's also this kind of moment with Namibia challenging Germany, and it's kind of like we're seeing this rise again of a kind of spirit that's always been latent since the era of decolonization, but I would say even much earlier than that, which is basically to say you claim to stand with these concepts of international law and international human rights and rules-based order, etc. Why aren't you? And, you know, this was the first challenge to this, or the first challenge to, for example, the principles of the French Revolution came from Haiti. C.L.R. James, who wrote this book on the Black Jacobins on the Haitian Revolution, said that when the challenge came from Haiti, people in the National Assembly would shove the rights of man deep into their pockets. You know, they don't want to make this appeal. And this is kind of what's at stake here. When South Africa comes up and Namibia comes up and all of these countries, regardless of whether or not what it will actually do to prevent a genocide, the fact that it's happening is, I think, something that caught the Western world and Israel off guard. But it's also, again, part of that same tradition of third world anti-colonial tradition of saying, we believe in these concepts which you claim to profess more than you believe in these concepts. And we're here to rescue them from you. And I think that that's why the default position to try to push back against that has to be that these people are uncivilized, these people are corrupt, these people can't be trusted. And I think that that's really what's at stake with these challenges.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I want to ask you about the United Nations. Of course, the Secretary General of the UN has been quite forceful in denouncing the record number of killings of UN personnel. And of course, many United Nations officials have been very bluntly outspoken about the nature of the war that Israel is waging. But when it comes to what can the United Nations actually do, it's become more clear during these past 4 months than I think ever in history that the United States governs over a system where it alone decides who the bad guys are in the world, where it alone will decide whether bombs are dropped or cease to be falling. And you have this dance that plays out where nations of the world make their arguments, oftentimes based on legal precedent and the precedent of international law in the United Nations as to why Israel must cease its operations against Gaza. And on the other side, you have the United States treating it as basically just a discussion society that the U.S. is forced to sit through. And then at the end of the day, whoever happens to be sitting in the chair of the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. vetoes what the vast majority of nations and people of the world have made clear that they believe is a just course. I want you to talk, though, about the role of the United Nations in everything that we're witnessing, and the message that is sent when, at the end of the day, the Secretary General of the UN can basically be begging for an end to this war, and yet the United States says, no, 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 it doesn't work that way. It works this way. We say when things end. We say when the burning fire is put out.
You know, actually, this is really interesting, Jeremy, because when I first learned about the Hague Act, that was actually from you during the times when you wrote Drone Wars. And it just blew my mind that there was a law which said that if the United States is ever taken to the ICC, that it could invade The Hague and the diplomatic spat that happened afterwards. I mean, I think what's more worrying, for the longest time we've already known, and I think it's clear to everybody now, that international law is a tool that's wielded by the powerful, former colonizing countries, and also the new empires of the world. But I think what's more terrifying is that now we almost feel like we also have to be on the defensive of the UN. Because after decolonization happened, there was a moment of hope that the UN General Assembly could be this place, one person, one vote. And you have all of a sudden, for the first time in the world, it's not just a few countries, Spain, France, Britain, and the United States, etc., who are deciding the agenda on the world stage, but it's the entire world. And there was even hopes when there was a proposal by Algeria in the early 1970s for a new international economic order for the UN General Assembly to kind of be a legislative body of kind of like a world republic, for example. Of course, that didn't happen. And the Security Council system happened instead. And that was a way in which the hegemony of the United States, you know, came into full gear. And then, of course, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States has been virtually unchallenged when it comes to these kinds of things. And so, you know, right now, the best way to look at the UN is to see it as both an extension of Western power. For example, when we're talking about debt, global debt, the ability to forgive the debt would be so easy if the United States said, but it doesn't. When it comes to all sorts of things related to, for example, dealing with the biggest threat to the entire species right now, which is the life supporting systems of our planet, which is climate change and facilitation of loss and damages and all of that stuff. Obviously, the UN is an obstacle. At the same time, the UN's humanitarian organizations are the last lifeline for people in Gaza, for example, right now, UNRWA. And what we're actually seeing, which is even regardless of the fact that the United States and Western countries profess and claim to be standing for the rules-based order, we're seeing that the biggest assault against that rules-based order is being waged by the West. It's no small thing right now, the pulling out funding of UNRWA. It's no small thing that the heads of states of Western powers, and it's even divided the West. And I haven't seen something like this in a long time, where you have, for example, Norway and Ireland and Spain saying that it's a bad idea. What are we doing? Like, it's to that level. And so all of a sudden, for the first time, I'm even finding myself in a position where on the one side, the UN legitimates, and like you said, it becomes a discussion room for all these countries. On the other side, I feel that the only groups of people, and this is one of the things that has been a surprising turn, the only people who are defending the idea that there should be international norms and rules, and that, you know, you shouldn't be openly attacking the only thing that represents that aspiration, seems to be the Global South, you know? And whereas, like, the biggest group to kind of attack the UN as biased, and Israel is openly hostile towards the United Nations. But the way in which people have fallen in line after this investigation on the, or not even an investigation, after the claims of the Israeli government on the UNRWA staff being involved in the Hamas attack, and that's been really, really horrifying to watch.
Well, and you also, you had Israel first saying that 12 UNRWA staffers were involved in some capacity directly in the attacks of October 7th. And then you had Israel giving its so-called dossier to a number of news organizations. And the first news organization to do a significant report about this was the Wall Street Journal, and they published, they sort of elevated it even higher and said that a full 10% of the local staff, UNRWA is a 30,000 employee organization, 12,000 or so of its employees are Gaza based. And so the Wall Street Journal does this big story where they say, it's not just 12, you know, bad apples, it's that 10% of the organization is in some way linked to Hamas, which in and of itself is a risible, you know, thing to say, because Hamas is the governing authority in Gaza. And simply saying that someone is linked to Hamas without defining it means absolutely nothing. But also you had Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying publicly that the United States had not even done its own investigation into the veracity of the claims before very publicly vowing to suspend its funding to UNRWA, which then created a domino effect. And you had then other powerful, wealthy nations say, we're going to do the same thing. But then you had the Financial Times and Sky News and some other media outlets also review this dossier. And, you know, these are not exactly leftist publications, but they said that what Israel is alleging is not substantiated even in the documents that Israel is providing. And now you have a walk back where they appear to be saying, oh, well, four members of UNRWA were involved in some capacity in, you know, in the events of October 7th. So you this is just the latest episode in Israel's campaign to bombard the marketplace of ideas with propaganda, with lies, with disinformation, misinformation. And time and time again, we have seen the United States in particular not just repeat Israel's allegations, but often say, we actually have other intelligence to indicate that this is true. They did that with Al-Shifa Hospital, for example. But on this issue, I also wanted to transfer to asking you about the way that armed resistance is talked about, partially in this conflict, but in general, when you're talking about people who are facing down against oppression from either powerful nations or allies of powerful nations, as in the case of Israel. Now, you know, we can talk specifically about the events of October 7th, and I think that we should separate the attacks that Hamas launched against military facilities. I mean, Hamas has its own narrative, and it published its, you know, its multi-page defense of its actions, and it stated that its intent was to go after military targets, and they have their own definition of who's a civilian and who's not that we don't need to get into. It's clear that there were war crimes committed by Hamas on October 7th. I don't think anyone reasonable could deny that. You don't kidnap children. You don't kidnap, you know, elderly people. You don't shoot unarmed people who are trying to surrender. This isn't a political thing I'm saying, it's a legal thing. These are war crimes. At the same time, the overarching narrative about Palestinians in general, and we've seen it in a very acute way here, is that they are not allowed to have any form of resistance that Israel does not permit. And even when they've demonstrated nonviolently, they've been gunned down. But this notion that is being drilled into the public mind, that the mere notion that Palestinians would take up arms against what the United Nations continues to maintain is an occupation, not just in the West Bank, but in Gaza as well, is rooted in a very long history of criminalizing all forms of unsanctioned defense of populations that are the victims of colonialism, or in this case, violent settler colonialism and an apartheid state.
Yeah, that's entirely correct. And that's actually something that a lot of third world countries in the 20th century tried to push for to be recognized in international law. And actually the right to armed resistance against colonial occupation is a right that is actually protected under international law. Many people don't know that. But I think one of the things that makes this so much more complicated is that we now live also in an era of the war and terror. And one of the key kinds of ideas is that, like, because of the fact that so many countries went through these phases of national liberation, with maybe some of the last key national liberation movements in the early 1990s, but generally the majority of it being 70s and the 60s, so we're talking about Algeria, we're talking about Mozambique, etc. A lot of attempts to try to resist colonial occupations, which continue to exist today, are easily branded as terrorism. And one of the reasons for that is because there's a template which the United States has set, which equates resistance with terrorism and which then plays into the geopolitical interests of that country. And there's all sorts of discourses and ideas on the media, on movies, on TV, television shows, which makes it very difficult today for any group to be legible as being a group that's legitimately fighting for its national liberation. One of the things that the United States is very known for is that it is a country which sees its own war of independence as a canonical event in its history in order to have existed. And there was a really interesting conversation that Huey Newton had, I think, with William Buckley, where the first thing that Huey Newton catches William Buckley off guard, and he says, you know, would have you joined the Revolutionary War? And, you know, William Buckley didn't know how to respond, and he waffled a bit. And I mean, that's the thing. It's like, if you're going to condemn a country's ability to come out of a war or an armed resistance or an armed struggle, then the United States must condemn itself. And yeah, it does. And it regularly does, because it's kind of like we got here first and closed the door behind us. And that's kind of how Palestinian, but I mean, the thing is that we saw through the Oslo Accords, there was an attempt to go through the peaceful route, and the Oslo Accords ended up just providing a rubber stamp to the Palestinian Authority working with the Israelis as a kind of like a proxy force for the occupation. We saw just last year when there was the peaceful marches and people were just getting sniped one after the other. They tried the peaceful march approach. They tried the international law approach. They've tried through the ICC. And then, of course, they've also tried, and there's been a history of trying armed resistance. But in regard, I think this kind of ties in again with the UNRWA defunding in this sense. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they try, because at the end of the day, Israel civil society, very unfortunate for me to say, has basically, the narrative is that Palestinian people, especially the people in Gaza, are, to use the language that has been popularized as of late, the civil wing of Hamas. Actually, they are Hamas. They hide Hamas in their doors, in their homes. They sympathize with Hamas secretly. They're raising their kids to become Hamas. And so it's fair game. Yeah, it's fair game to deprive them of their rights, to deprive them of humanitarian assistance. Because as far as the people who wrote that dossier are concerned, this is a formality for them. It doesn't matter. There's no need to prove UNRWA is Hamas. UNRWA is Hamas for the fact that it employs Palestinian people. And so now it's just a matter. And this okay, obviously this attack against UNRWA has we saw it on the Trump administration. It's not new, you know. What's worse is that effectively, because of what we talked about the flaws of the UN system, the way that the ICJ report was written, and this was the argument that South Africa made, it was written in such a way where the only way in which you could bring in humanitarian assistance to the peoples, which was one of the demands of the court, is for a ceasefire. How Israel responded to that, the response was quite simply that we will outsource the potential genocide which we're engaging in Gaza to our allies. And the allies, they joined in. And so what ends up happening now is that those war crimes are being outsourced using the same discourses, which prevent Palestinians from even resisting, which is basically that, you know, they deserve it. They deserve to not have aid. They're complicit in the attack, And if you do it, it's like they did it, not us. You know, that's their crime, not mine. And I think that's really what is at the heart of all of this.
How has the war against Gaza been received in other countries that have been subjected to violent colonialism or apartheid? I mean, maybe you can walk through a couple of notable examples.
I mean, I think the best example, obviously, is South Africa, because I think South Africa, Namibia, many of the entire world was just colonized, basically. And I think one of the main reasons is because, again, it's kind of like this opportunity to confront the West with the hypocrisy, but also it really is about seeing the higher ideals of that are actually a positive contribution of the West, for example, to the world, the ideals of human rights, the ideals of human liberty, and to confront that head on with a system which, you know, desecrates that. And Israel is a perfect opportunity for this. I mean, I was watching COP28 and I saw all of the heads of states, and a huge amount of them condemned what was going on in Gaza in the first international meeting after the attack. And so you saw, it was very clear. And you saw Gustavo Petro in Colombia, who has been very outspoken and has even suggested that South Africa be given the Nobel Peace Prize. But you also saw Chile, which has a huge population of the Palestinian diaspora, the biggest outside of the Middle East. You saw Honduras. In general, it became a rallying cry for a host of other issues, because a lot of these countries were also fighting for loss and damages on climate reparations. Basically, what Israel has done to Gaza has had reverberations, basically, on the multilateral level of a kind of division that's happened since maybe the Bandung conference, which is basically that you have a lot of these formerly colonized countries, third world countries, saying that they're not interested in being pawns of a Cold War, and that they're non-aligned, and that what they want is a complete redrawing of the architecture of the global economy and the global systems of international law. And that's why it has been an event which has brought people back together and reignited that spirit. And I think that's why it's not just about what's going on in Gaza. Gustavo Petro made the connection, for example, he said that Gaza is kind of like the future, and that in a world where the vast majority of the world's population is becoming redundant and we are not prepared to tackle the risk of climate-induced disaster, there'll be more Gazas, and that Europe will respond, this is what he said, to these waves of migration and et cetera, with the same doctrine of extermination, which is imposing on Gaza. And so in many ways, it's not just about the legacies of colonialism and existing colonialism, but it's about trying to create a new order, a new international order, where everybody is seen as equal, and trying to use this as an opportunity to not just defend Gaza, but to defend the idea that every state and every person is equal, and that there are no hierarchies of who deserves justice and who doesn't, and to push back against the idea that the only people who should face justice are those who are geopolitically convenient to the United States.
Just to clarify for people that might not be familiar with that history, when you mentioned the Bandung Conference of 1955, it was one of the most important early meetings of what would become known as the Non-Aligned Movement. Countries around the world, Yugoslavia was part of it, India was part of it, Egypt was part of it, Kwame Nkrumah and other revolutionary leaders were part of it. And the notion was that most of the world's people in what is now referred to as the Global South should not cast their lot with either the United States or the Soviet Union in an exclusive manner. Instead, they should develop a third way of functioning in international relations, where you didn't become either a puppet for or a slave to either of these dominant spheres of influence that emerged in the aftermath of World War II. But speaking of colonialism, I wanted to ask you about Britain and its position on Palestine and how the British government has proceeded over these past 4 months, because it's not just the governing right-wing conservative government in Britain, but also the leader of the so-called opposition Labour in Britain and his full-throttled support for Israel. Talk a bit about how this war has played out on a domestic level in the UK.
So on the one side in the UK, it's been a moment of radicalization for a lot of youth. And I say that in a positive sense of the word, radicalization in the sense that people are now understanding that there's a root cause problem in the way that the world order is structured, and they're ready to fight for what's right and to fight for legitimate humanist ideals. On the other side, there's been a huge disenfranchisement, especially of Muslim communities. There was just a poll that was released yesterday, which showed that dramatic drop in support for the Labour Party since Keir Starmer publicly said that he thought that cutting off water, food and electricity to the people of Gaza is Israel's right. And sort of the Labour Party tries to resolve its bad rep now with progressives and with a lot of Muslims by claiming that it supports a Palestinian state. But this is obviously a ruse, because it's kind of like the illegal settlements continue to expand, the siege never lifted on Gaza, but we support the idea of a Palestinian state. But then when the Palestinian Authority tries to lobby for one in the international sphere, they'll support to veto it, or they'll abstain, things like that. I mean, it's people are not buying it, right? But there was one story which I found quite really horrific, which was that there was a man who had lost lots of his family members in Gaza. He'd met Angela Rayner, who's a key figure in the Labour Party opposition, and he protested against her. And then I think there was an interview with Sky News or something with Angela Rayner, and they asked her, how do you feel? You know, did it remind you of the time when there was another politician called Joe Cox who was killed by a far right person? Did it remind you of that? And she made herself out to be as if she's the victim of, again, same tropes, you know, this brute Palestinian man. And I think one of the things that I've also been really surprised with, and it's one of those things, again, it's part of the same episode principle dynamics, there's been this interesting thing about the criminalization of the Palestinian flag. It's something that's happening in Germany as well. And in the UK, we have this non-binding definition by the IHRA, which of anti-Semitism, which says that attacking the state of Israel is a form of anti-Semitism, etc. And one of the things also is denying the right for Israel to exist. But for Palestinians, denying the right, the existence of a Palestinian people is something which is socially acceptable and even encouraged. One of the things that's really interesting is that people say that waving a Palestinian flag is a provocation against Jews. And I think that that's very telling, in the sense that the existence, a flag symbolizes a peoplehood, it symbolizes the existence of a nation, the existence of people. And to say that waving their flag is a provocation means that the existence of those very people is seen as a provocation. And that should show you more generally that the existence of the Palestinian people is seen as an inconvenience. And that's why it's become morally and socially acceptable to speak of them, to speak of ethnic cleansing as a solution to the Gaza question, you know? I mean, that's kind of how they see it. This is perfectly acceptable. And so there's this huge distance, and I think this is something you could probably relate to in the United States, between the commentariat, between the press and the people who were on their social media, on Twitter, etc. And they're seeing this potential genocide being live streamed on their phones. It's a live streamed genocide. And the Labour Party is just completely out of touch. I am someone who has been committed to the Labour Party. I'm not going to vote for the Labour Party in the next general election. And I think there are many people who feel the same, because if this is not a red line, then what is? I think that this is a turning point for a lot of people, in the sense that the status quo in Palestine is being rejected and renounced. And just a year ago, with all of the normalization agreements that were happening between Israel and the countries around it, I mean, the fact that we passed the threshold where people said that Gaza would be an unlivable place by 2020, it almost felt hopeless. But I think one of the bright things about this, regardless of the awful position of the Labour Party, one of the really great things that's come out of this is the fact that people are now demanding an end to that status quo. And I'm seeing that at least among young people here in Britain. And I think that also kind of contributes to why someone like Nikki Haley is saying that every 15 minutes someone spends on TikTok, they become anti-Semitic or something silly like that.
As we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about the movement for decolonization. Now, of course, part of your work is dealing with resurrecting stories from history and making them current, but also addressing current manifestations of colonialism. Talk for a moment as we wrap up about your work on decolonization.
Yeah, so I'm part of a project called the Decolonial Center, which is a project of the Pluto Educational Trust here in the UK. We started this project and we have a team that's across the world with some members in Brazil and Sudan. In general, the main idea is that colonialism never came to an end, and that coloniality, or like the legacies of colonialism, continue to inform present day politics. There are some countries which are still under colonial occupation, Palestine being one, but there's other places like Western Sahara, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, etc. There's many, colonialism still exists. And so what we need to do is wear a political education outfit which tries to inform people about not just about colonialism. I think that there's been great work already that's being done lately on colonialism, but more importantly on traditions of anti-colonialism and traditions of decolonization. And what we're trying to do ultimately is to inspire people to coalesce. We don't claim to lead any decolonial movement, but we know that there are already movements working on decolonization in various ways. And what we want to do is we want to produce a space for them as a forum for debate, for discussion, and to reignite that same spirit of Bandung, which you talked about, Jeremy. Let's see where it goes. Right now, we're going to launch our newscast soon. We've got a mini encyclopedia where people can learn about colonialism. And we've also got those videos which you're talking about. So we'll see where it goes. But I just want to take this opportunity to really thank The Intercept for being one of the few places and spaces to tell the truth. And there are consequences for telling the truth. There are lots of consequences, but that's the duty that a journalist makes. And so I just wanted to thank The Intercept for constantly telling the truth.
Well, thank you as well, Mohammed Naeem. We really appreciate you being with us here on Intercepted. We'll make sure to put links up to your organization and your work. Thanks so much for being with us on the show.
Thank you.
That was Mohammed El Naeem, the director of the Decolonial Center. You can find them at decolonialcenter.org. That's center spelled the British way, CENTRE.org, decolonialcenter.org. And that does it for this episode of Intercepted. Intercepted is a production of The Intercept. Jose Olivares is the lead producer. Our supervising producer is Laura Flynn. Roger Hodge is editor-in-chief of The Intercept. Rick Kwan mixed our show. Legal review by David Brelo and Elizabeth Sanchez. This episode was transcribed by Leonardo Fireman. Our theme music, as always, was composed by DJ Spooky. If you want to support our work, you can go to theintercept.com/join. Your donation, no matter what the size, makes a real difference. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Intercepted and do leave us a rating or a review wherever you find our podcasts. It helps other people to find us as well. If you want to give us additional feedback, you can always email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.